This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
How does a nation conduct a successful six-year naval campaign and become one of the largest navies in the world? To discuss the 75th anniversary of the conclusion of the Battle of the Atlantic is Chris Perry, Command Historian of the Royal Canadian Navy. Chris, welcome to Preble Hall.
Thank you.
And I wish to convey on behalf of the Naval Academy Museum and the Navy our condolences to you and your shipmates in the Royal Canadian Navy on the recent loss of the shipmates aboard HMCS Fredericton. I know every day is unexpected at sea, and this is something that we never wish to see. So you have our condolences, sir.
Thank you.
How did you become the command historian for the Royal Canadian Navy?
I joined the reserves when I was 17, high school. Thought it would be a fun thing to do. I was a bosun in the Naval Reserves. That's kind of our general seaman. Does everything from small boat seamanship evolutions, small arms, some explosives, stuff like that. Just when you think of a sailor, that's what a bosun is. I did that for a while going to university. One day I was thinking, wow, I've got a lot of student loans and I'm not having fun anymore. You know what? I will transfer to the regular force for a little bit, pay off my student loans, and go back to school. In 99, I transferred to the regular force as a sonar operator. I was just going to do it for a couple of years. Then they sucked me in like they do, and I realized I really enjoyed it. They kept giving us pay raises. And
Wait, your Navy gets pay raises?
Oh, well, yeah.
I need to talk to my Navy about this.
Yeah. Well, I joined just at the end. We had almost a decade-long pay freeze. So I joined just at the end of that. So we got a huge pay raise. I think it was like 19%. And then I realized I was enjoying it. So I stayed. Then the opportunity came to apply for a program we call UTP-NCM, University Training Plan Non-Commissioned Member, to go to university, get your degree, and become an officer. So I applied and I was accepted. So I went to the University of Victoria and I worked my butt off and I got 2 degrees out of it. First degree was a sociology and I did a degree in history. And I loved the department. I loved the work, the reading, everything. So when I went back to the Navy as a acting sub-lieutenant, attending my naval officer training, I talked to one of my old professors, Dr. David Zimmerman, and said, well, I'm thinking about, you know, when I get a chance doing a master's in war studies. And I was thinking about University of Swansea. And he said, well, if you're going to do war studies, you've got to go to King's, King's College London. I said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So when I was thinking about master's, I applied to King's. While I did my naval officer training, I did a master's in War in the Modern World from King's College London, go to sea for our sea phases, come into port, do all my chart preps and plans and everything. And I'd run to a hotel room and I write my paper. I finished my master's, but at the same time I finished my new officer training. 2016, I saw the posting for the command historian for the Royal Canadian Navy. I got it, and it's the best job in the world.
Well, people will, especially the United States Navy, will recognize your last name for a reason. We chatted about this yesterday. Who exactly are you related to in the U.S. Navy?
I'm related to Oliver Hazard Perry and Matthew Galbraith Perry. Oliver Hazard Perry from the War of 1812. We've met the enemy, they are ours. And Matthew Galbraith Perry from his negotiations with Japan.
Well, since you're related to the Perrys and all my ancestors are from Quebec, maybe we should change jobs at some point, Chris. When was the first time you really became aware of the significance of the Battle of the Atlantic and Canada's role in it?
The first Sunday in May is the Battle of the Atlantic Sunday. It's the Royal Canadian Navy's remembrance of specifically the Battle of the Atlantic and the ships lost, not just in the Navy, but also in the Canadian Merchant Navy and the Royal Canadian Air Force. So it's a parade every first Sunday in May. Being Canadians, we don't talk about our military history that much.
Why is that?
We have this national idea of the citizen soldier or citizen sailor. Something happens, we call up the militia, we go, we fight, we do really well. But then the rest of the time, we go back to being our nice, peaceful country.
We'd like to learn more about the 75th anniversary, and that concludes today. 75 years ago, and can you characterize its role within the greater part of World War II?
The Battle of the Atlantic was the campaign against the German U-boats to supply the United Kingdom and the Soviet Union during the Second World War. It was bringing mostly convoys across the Atlantic, but it also dressed down the Caribbean, across to Africa, into the Mediterranean. It was thousands of tons of ships and material being brought across in, you know, probably some of the worst weather and seas in the world, to have that vital supply link of food, materials, weapons, personnel to support England and the Soviet Union in their fight against Nazis.
It starts in September of 1939, is that correct?
That's correct.
And that is amazing, because when you consider how large the Canadian Navy was, what, it was 13 or 14 ships?
We had 13 ships, not very big.
Now, how does a country like Canada mobilize in that case? Because the United States is at this point 2 years from entering the war. It is unable to contribute directly any naval support. So how does Canada convert and mobilize to address this U-boat threat?
By hard work and everyone. This was a national effort. It wasn't just the Navy. It was dockyard workers. It was every shipyard that had access to the ocean building ships, warships, merchant ships. We built a whole set of what we call the Fort class merchant ships that we sent to England as part of the Lend-Lease program. And we built the Park ships for us. Merchants, we built merchant seamen schools. We set up recruiting centers at all. Every province has naval reserve units. We built up recruiting centers there, and they did, you know, tiny bit of training before they went off for their basic training. People sacrificed. People rationed. They sent in their scraps, their metal, their bones. Everyone, the Inuit, went out and gathered bones to make glue and ammunition. The entire country mobilized to put our ships to sea and to protect these convoys.
Can you give us a sense of how many convoys made it across the Atlantic throughout the war?
It was hundreds. It was usually about two a week. It started out, they had two sets of convoys going from Halifax. They'd go to Halifax, Newfoundland, and then across. Or the first one just went Halifax across. And they had slow convoys and fast convoys.
What's the difference between a slow convoy and a fast convoy?
Slow convoys would go between 8 to 12 knots on average. Fast convoys were over 12.
Why make that distinction? Was it the type of cargo that was being transported?
No, it was just the type of ships they had at the time. I mean, some of these ships still ran on coal, and our corvettes were small and wet.
Let's talk about the corvettes for a second, because when I was up in Halifax maybe 20 years ago, I got an opportunity to see one of those incredible ships. Tell us about the role of the corvettes, and that's a Flower-class corvette, if I recall.
Yes.
Correct?
They were Flower-class corvettes based on a British design. They were small, they were leaky, they were wet, they rolled in the heavy dew.
These are not large ships. They're maybe 200 feet long, maybe or so?
We built them here in Canada because they were easy to build, and we built a lot of them. But we built them everywhere, from the West Coast to along the Great Lakes to the East Coast. We built corvettes everywhere.
Were those the primary ships you used to escort the convoys in the Battle of the Atlantic?
They were the main ships. We also used some minesweepers. Were built, you know, for minesweeping, but mm-hmm. they wound up as escorts. We used some destroyers, some of our tribal class destroyers, and river class frigates. But the tribal class destroyers mostly did the Arctic convoys.
And so before the United States comes into the war, is it essentially just the Canadian Navy that's escorting these convoys across the Atlantic? Are there any other allies involved? Well, for about 3 years, because I don't think the United States didn't really come in to convoy protection until about maybe late 42 or early 43, right?
Yeah, you had an admiral who thought convoys wouldn't work until he saw the devastation the mm-hmm. U-boats were causing on your merchant shipping along the east coast of the U.S. We had help from the Royal Navy the Royal Air Force and the Royal Canadian Air Force.
To what degree is the Royal Canadian Air Force able to provide protection for the convoys, given the distance between maritime provinces and Iceland? I mean, what's the range that the Royal Canadian Air Force has at this time?
See, that's where we're getting into the problems. We could protect ships for a certain distance out, and it got better as the war went on with better ships or better planes with more range. There was that center, it was called the North Atlantic Gap or the Black Pit, where there was no air coverage. Because if you're going to fight a submarine, doing it from the air is the best way to do it. Otherwise, you're getting into a knife fight with ramming and depth charges. That air cover was essential, and the increases in the range of airplanes and the better airplanes to cover that more of that gap. They tried things like they had merchant ships that were converted into somewhat aircraft carriers to help with air cover. The Brits had, you know, aircraft carriers out. We did everything we could to increase that air cover.
But that only comes later in the war to protect. So essentially, once the Royal Canadian Air Force reach their range, they have to return home. The convoys are essentially on their own at that point, middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Now, is that where the U-boats generally would strike?
We had U-boats right up the St. Lawrence, like off the coast of Quebec in the St. Lawrence Seaway.
In the St. Lawrence?
Yes.
Is the St. Lawrence that deep? I guess it has deep draft ships going through, so, okay.
That change from the freshwater to saltwater provides different layers. It helps submarines hide, because if your sonar, or this time it was ASDIC, sounds lazy, so it will go to the path of recession. So if there's a layer, it'll tend to bounce off. So it's easy for submarines to hide in the St. Lawrence. We had attacks as far up as, maybe 100, 200 miles east of Montreal.
That brings you, what, to about Île d'Orléans? Or just maybe a little north of that?
Cape Chat.
Did the U-boats sink any ships in the St. Lawrence Seaway?
Yes, we lost warships in the St. Lawrence Seaway.
Which warships did you lose?
HMCS Brador, HMCS Charlottetown, HMCS Chedebucto, HMCS Raccoon in the St. Lawrence.
How successful eventually were you to deter the U-boats from the St. Lawrence Seaway? What did you do to prevent them from either entering or at least trying to identify them sooner?
Increased air cover, and we shut down the St. Lawrence. This was coming in 42 at the height of the U-boat successes. So the government, we also lost a ferry called the Caribou that travels between Sydney and Newfoundland. And we lost merchant ships. With this, it's hard to hide it from the public because survivors are coming ashore. So the government had an emergency session and to figure out what they do, and they decide just to shut down the St. Lawrence for the season.
And so that's two-way traffic then. It's anything coming. So all the ships that you're building in the Great Lakes can't make it through the St. Lawrence Seaway.
At that time. So we shut this down, St. Lawrence, and this was coming. So increased U-boat. This was the height of the U-boat success. We were being called to send more ships to Europe to assault Europe. We were being pulled in different directions. And then they also had a submarine go into what's called Belle Island, off Belle Island in Newfoundland. And we had a submarine come in and sink a few ships. There's one part I find very interesting is a German submarine landed on Labrador, part of the province of Newfoundland, Labrador on the mainland. And they built a weather station Kurt, that wasn't discovered until the 70s.
To what extent was, I mean, how big was the facility?
Oh, it looks like three barrels and a post. It was discovered in the 70s because I think a gentleman who worked for Siemens was retired and thought he'd make a history of the company and discovered all these reports about this. And the submarine who put the weather station on, they went on and were sunken afterwards. So the records of this weather station, and apparently it worked for, you know, a day or so and then died. So he discovered it, and they went, and Parks Canada went and found it, and then now it's sitting in as an exhibit in the Canadian War Museum.
Oh, that's amazing. Chris, who are some of the major figures in the Royal Canadian Navy at this time, specifically for the Battle of the Atlantic? What are their roles?
Well, we had Rear Admiral Leonard Murray. He's the only Canadian to command an Allied theater of operations during the war. He commanded the Newfoundland Escort Force. So he was in charge of the ships that were escorting from basically Newfoundland off Iceland, Greenland. One of my favorite quotes, I'm digging through the archives just before the COVID shut everything down. I found the transcripts of a conference in 46 to discuss the effects and what happened, like a hot wash up of the Battle of the Atlantic. Rear Admiral Murray was there and he makes this comment. In 1941-42, corvettes under my command were escorting the convoys between Newfoundland and Iceland in weather conditions for which they were not suited, and they were manned almost completely by amateurs. These officers and men of the volunteer reserves were better able to stand up to these conditions than the hardened old salts, because they did not know enough to expect anything better. Technical and tactical aids were of infinite value, but the battle was won by what is commonly called guts, and that applied not only to the escort forces, but also to the merchant navy. And then he goes on to talk about Captain Prentice, J.D. Prentice, who was one of the most successful U-boat hunters. And they say he'd been managing a cattle ranch. So he protected his convoys like a cowboy riding around a herd. We had Ralph Hennessy and John Stubbs. John Stubbs was commanding officer of HMCS Assiniboine. And Ralph Hennessy was his executive officer at the time, and they sank U-210, and this was, so they went in, they dropped depth charge, they got the submarine onto the surface, and then they rammed it. So John Stubbs is on the flying bridge, the big open bridge, bullets whizzing around, and people said he was giving conning orders like he was at a garden party. The submarine guns started a fire on the wooden superstructure of the ship. And the executive officer's job is to do damage control, to lead the damage control parties. And there was fire all around. Ralph Hennessy grabs one of the halyards from the mast and swings down like a pirate to take control of the damage control organization. And in the wheelhouse, which is under the bridge, the chief Max Bernays, ordered the other two sailors out. So he handled the helm and the telegraph by himself, performing dozens of telegraph and helm orders to fight this submarine while bullets are coming through the superstructure and everything's on fire. And my favorite story is about Hal Lawrence in HMCS Oakville. They're in the Caribbean and they're fighting, going after a submarine, or U-94. A U.S. Navy PB is also assisting. So they get this U-boat on the surface, and they're close enough that the crew are throwing pop bottles. So then they decided they're going to send a Clarence King, who is also a very successful submarine hunter. They're sending a boarding party. So the boarding party is all getting ready. While they're getting loaded up, there's an explosion. They get blown into the ocean. And the only ones that are in any shape to do things are Hal Lawrence, who is a sub-lieutenant, maybe a lieutenant at the time, and a petty officer. And Hal Lawrence, due to the explosion and the water, winds up boarding of this submarine dressed only with a pistol and a life belt. So these two guys take this German submarine naked, armed with a pistol.
Was ramming a common tactic for either the corvettes or the destroyers against the U-boats during the Battle of the Atlantic.
Yes, very common.
Was it successful?
Yes. Before the advent of the hedgehog, which is
what was the hedgehog?
They were forward throwing anti-submarine weapons. Depth charges came off the sides or the rear of the ship. The Aztec pointed forward, so you would have to break contact to get over, and then hopefully, you know, you could drop the submarines or drop the depth charges. And then once they were on the surface, ramming was usually because if you could damage the submarine, they couldn't sink again. Ramming was a common tactic.
What would you say were some of the contributing factors to the success of the Royal Canadian Navy in the Battle of the Atlantic?
As Leonard Murray said, guts. Just the support of the nation. and the hard work, determination. We had a steep learning curve because we had a very small regular force, and then we had a little bit bigger Royal Canadian Naval Reserve, which was made up of professional seamen, including some Royal Canadian Mounted Police from the Marine section that came over to the Navy. And then the majority of it, of the Navy, was the Royal Canadian Naval Volunteer Reserve, which are people who had never been to sea before and joined the Navy and learned their craft in probably the worst environment ever. The North Atlantic being attacked by German submarines.
And the survival rate, once you went into the water, and I think that's the key to this, if I understand correctly, is that you might go into lifeboats or you might be thrown overboard, but the survival time in the North Atlantic, especially because of that, the weather, is not a very long time. And is that where most of the losses occurred for the Royal Canadian Navy? And, and I want to say the Merchant Service, because the Merchant Service was an incredible force because they were lightly armed. They were the ones who were the targets of the U-boats, and so they suffered significant losses as well.
We had some big losses in the North Atlantic. HMCS St. Croix went down in 43 with 147 on board. HMCS Marguerite went down in the North Atlantic with 142 on board. And we had HMCS Esquimalt was lost in 1945, April 1945, outside Halifax, with 44 on board.
That's in the last month of the war. That's incredible. The U-boats were still operating that close to North American waters.
There was a merchant ship, Avondale Park, was lost on May 7th, 11 p.m., 1945, in the North Sea.
And technically that's after the conclusion of the Battle of the Atlantic, as it's commemorated. Is that correct?
We commemorated right up to VE Day. The British commemorated, I think, 43, because that was the height when the German Admiral Dönitz said, "We've lost the Battle of the Atlantic." They didn't mean they didn't stop fighting.
Do you ever have a chance in your position to speak with some of the Royal Canadian Navy sailors and merchant marine who fought in the Battle of the Atlantic?
I do often. There's not very many left, mm-hmm. unfortunately, but every chance I get, I do.
What are some of the stories, or what are some of the impressions you've had in speaking with them?
The pride that they have in what they accomplished. Talk to guys who were in the Navy for a brief period in their lives. Pride they have in what they did is just amazing. You know, guys in their 90s who still identify as sailors, even if they've never been on a ship since.
For today, will they be some of them will be participating in the 75th anniversary?
Unfortunately not. I think our wreath laying today is just commander of the RCN.
Is that because of COVID-19?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Sure. So, of course.
We had so many things planned. Hopefully, I mean, it's a commemoration. They can happen anytime. What's important is people's health.
Chris Perry, Command Historian for the Royal Canadian Navy, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And for our U.S. listeners, listeners around the world, and especially our Canadian allies and partners in these challenging times, hold fast. This too shall pass.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.